My name is Gianni Russo, a.k.a. Carlo, the infamous son-in-law from The Godfather. I'm now known as the Hollywood Godfather, and this is my story.
Before all of the wins in my portfolio, I was a little boy diagnosed with polio. Experimenting with cures, I tried every one. Felt everything in my right, but my left was numb. Walking with a limp, like will I ever run? Once again, or is this it? Am I forever done? Living in the hospital was never fun. Some people were cool, but not everyone.
Welcome, everybody. It's time for another Hollywood Godfather podcast. And before we go any further, let's introduce the ladies first. My grandmother would get mad if I didn't. Jeannie Raymond, our co-host.
Hello, everybody. So happy to be here, as usual.
And Mike, the Hollywood Kid.
Yes, sir. I'm doing great.
We have to thank you for our guest. And so we'll give you the honors of bringing him on. I can't wait to talk to him because his new book is the subject of a friend of mine for many, many years. And my neighbor, Marlon Brando.
All right, guys. So we got a great show tonight. So let me give it a quick little intro for our wonderful guest. Before there was James Dean, before there was Elvis Presley, there was Marlon Brando. Our guest this week, author, director, producer, Burt Kearns, has been referred to by Variety magazine as, quote, a show business and pop culture savant. Some of the great books he's written are Lawrence Tierney, Hollywood's Real Life Tough Guy, Tabloid Baby, The Show Won't Go On, co-written with Jeff Abraham. He joined us this week to talk about his latest book that came out April 2nd and is doing incredibly well. Marlon Brando, Hollywood Rebel. Please, guys, please welcome the one and only, the only guy I know has had a drink with Lawrence Tierney, the great Burt Kearns. Burt, thank you so much for joining us this week.
Hey, thanks for having me on. This is terrific.
I can't wait because, you know.
I want to ask you, Burt, real quick. I mean, there's been tons of Brando books. We all know this. You know, what do you think separates your book from all the other ones?
Well, I mean, that was the main issue I had when it came to time to writing a book about Marlon Brando. What else can you write? There's been so many biographies. There's 700 page books. Brando wrote a book. I looked at it, this being the 100th anniversary of Brando's birth, to look at what influence this guy has had 20 years after his death, 100 years after his birth, how he still influences pop culture today. And it all goes back to that poster I had on my wall when I was a kid back in the 1960s of Brando on that motorcycle in the Wild One. And you look at that and you see the hat, you see the leather jacket, you see the way he looks, and everything from, you know, rock and roll to civil rights to punk to art, etc., all came from Marlon Brando. And the way he lived his life and the roles he chose had a great influence on what goes on today.
Mm. That's Johnny. Wild. He changed my life. I know that. He was my only acting teacher. I don't know if you know that, Bert.
Yeah,
I do.
I have a couple of Godfather connections. I do a lot of documentaries. I made one comedy film. I wrote and produced a film called Cloud Nine, starring Burt Reynolds. It was a movie about Burt Reynolds played the coach of a beach volleyball team made up of strippers. We'll put that aside. I apologize for that. But my co-writer,
subject matter.
No, let's talk about that. Okay.
My co-writer.
That sounds great.
My co-writer and co-producer was a guy named Al Ruddy.
Wow.
And the executive producer was Gredrickson. Now, of course, we know Al won the Oscar for Best Picture for The Godfather. Gray got the Oscar for Godfather Part Two.
Right.
Gray was a great source in the book and told me a lot of Godfather stories. He passed away during my research.
I didn't realize that. I was going to ask.
Just last year.
Wow. You know,
but he was a terrific guy. You know, the funny thing about it, Gray was a good old boy from Oklahoma City. And he returned back to Oklahoma, and he went to the community college, started a film program, got the kids working on making movies, et cetera, became a professor, led this film department. I said, Gray, what's it like when you talk to these kids and you say, I worked with Marlon Brando. I know Marlon Brando. I worked with him on Apocalypse Now. And he said, kids never heard of Marlon Brando. Because a third of the kids didn't know what The Godfather was. So I hope this kind of brings us back into the spotlight again.
Yeah, I hope so too. I just renewed with Paramount and Viacom for another 10 years. I own all the IP.
Yeah.
The Godfather.
I have to ask you, Johnny, I'm sorry, you should be asking the questions, but the wedding scene at The Godfather, the great wedding scene. Gray told me, you know, how Brando had a great sense of humor. The cast, all those young would-be Brandos, all you young actors, loved working with the guy. And you had a mooning contest going on through the whole
show. He won it.
he won it during that wedding scene, I understand.
It, not only did he win it, but it was so embarrassing because there were 700 people there and maybe 150 kids. And it had to be, the biggest crowd to moon in. I mean, they were mooning each other coming down Park Avenue going to work. And we're waiting for it's a famous scene. Where he looks around, he sees Michael's not standing for the wedding portrait. So he tells the cameraman, we got to wait for Michael. And just as he said that, he drops his pants and moons everybody. And believe me, it was not a pretty sight.
Hey, mooning is, you just can't moon anybody anymore. I've never been a mooner, but I've got a son that I'm telling you, he was a mooning fool. You do it now, you're going to get in trouble. But I mean,
I was going to say, ain't that indecent exposure?
Oh yeah, you're in big trouble now if you do that. But I think it's quite funny if it doesn't get too crazy. So
yeah, the kissing bandit would be doing life right now.
Oh, exactly. No more good fun.
Bert, I want to talk a little bit. Obviously, in your book, this is why you're here. October 19th, 1944, Brando makes his Broadway debut in a play called I Remember Mama. In the book, you mentioned that he almost quit acting because of this play. Why was that?
I think it was a year and a half, seven shows a week, two on the weekend. And he hated doing the same role over and over again. And he couldn't take it. He always wanted to do something different. As a matter of fact, after I Remember Mama, he did a couple of other little parts on Broadway. And he was offered a role in a Eugene O'Neill play called The Iceman Cometh, one of the classics. He tried reading the script, fell asleep, didn't like it. And instead, he takes a role in a propaganda play called A Flag is Born. And this was a play put on by a group called the American League for a Free Palestine. And what they were doing was they were helping take the displaced Jews from World War II on boats to form this new country, this new state called Israel. And they were also using some of the money to give Menachem Begin and the Irgun terrorists a little money for guns to help convince the British to allow these guys to go through. So anyway, Brando went and he was the only non-Jew in the cast. He was the star of the show. And when the show was over, he and another actor got on a bus and gave speeches at synagogues all around the country in favor of this. So again, activism for Brando was always much more important than acting, as you saw through his entire career.
Wow. I was in the audience when he got the Best Picture award, and he let the Indian go up and get the award for it.
Yeah,
that was his biggest protest. He wasn't even there. That's crazy.
I know. It's crazy.
Did she pass recently?
She did.
She just died. But they gave her an Oscar 2 years ago in recognition for the abuse and misuse of the Indians in film.
Hmm. What was her name? Does anyone know her name?
Sasheen Littlefeather.
Yep.
Yeah, Sasheen Littlefeather.
Sasheen Littlefeather.
Yep. Yeah, we want to give her due right here. That's
Let's get into Streetcar Named Desire, obviously the Tennessee Williams well-written play. Talk about, obviously, I mean, he was making a name for himself. And, then all of a sudden Stanley Kowalski role came up and, everything went, he blew up.
Yeah, Stanley Kowalski, the role originally was supposed to be played by John Garfield, the great actor. They offered it to Burt Lancaster. He couldn't get out of his movie contract to do it. And they all thought that Brando was too young and too pretty and too sensitive to play this Polish, rapist is what Stanley Kowalski was in the end. Brando came on and he went out and he met Tennessee Williams, the playwright out in Provincetown on Cape Cod. I don't know what went on between the two of them, but somehow he convinced Tennessee Williams to give him the part.
Brando turned into the handyman down there.
He did. They said he put his hand down the toilet. He fixed the broken toilet. He put the lights back on in his cottage, and he got the role. And right away, Brando changed Broadway. There was a way that actors acted on stage. You know, they read their lines, and you know, like Shakespearean actors, Brando didn't. He mumbled. If his butt itched him, he scratched it on stage. If he had a cold, he'd blow his nose on stage. He brought this reality to the stage that no one had ever brought before. And later he brought the same thing to movies and to motion pictures. You know, a lot of people I talked to in the book, they compared him to Bob Dylan. You know, he said, you know, before Bob Dylan came along, you could be Frank Sinatra, you could be Doris Day, you could just be a singer singing someone else's songs. But once Dylan came along, it changed the whole thing. You had to, you know, to be make it big in current pop music, you had to, you know, do your own music and then tell your own story. And that's what Brando did.
Yeah, I mean, the buzz back then for a streetcar to go see Brando, because again, he was a hot commodity. He was this kid who, you know, young kid, you know, he was a punk in school pretty much. And bang, here he comes on stage and everybody's blown away.
And then also the secret to this, what I found out, was, you know, it was sex. Brando brought raw sex. Those T-shirts he wore, those sweaty T-shirts, they made him a size too small on purpose. They made the pants a little bit small too, so everybody in the audience could see the muscles popping out and everything else popping out that Brando had. And he brought this raw sex to the stage that people had never seen before. I mean, his co-star was Jessica Tandy, and she was, you know, she was a Broadway actress. She didn't like working with him at all because what happened was, the audience was supposed to be on her side, on Blanche DuBois' side, the woman's side. Brando was supposed to be the villain, but the audiences loved him, and the audience started, you know, it started became Brando's play. And Elia Kazan, the director, said, "What am I going to do? Tell him to don't act as well? You know, act worse?"
Yeah, yeah.
He was just too good, man. He's too good.
No, he's just definitely a seed stealer.
Oh yeah.
So let's get into his Hollywood stuff. So, you know, he goes out to Hollywood. He's on fire. He's on fire coming off a streetcar. I mean, what's the buzz? He's a hot commodity. I mean, what are the columnists, like Hedda Hopper? What are they thinking about this guy? All of a sudden, he came out of nowhere.
Well, they call him the brat from Broadway, first of all, because he's too good for Hollywood. When you go to Hollywood, you're supposed to bow down in front of Hedda Hopper and answer any questions she has. He ignored her. He wouldn't do it. He didn't go to the Macambo or Ciro's with starlets. He didn't go at any of these places. And he wouldn't sign with the studio. He said, "No, I want to make movies that I want to make." First movie he takes is with Stanley Kramer, the producer who did Message Pictures and, you know, liberal Message Pictures. He does a show.
And Bad World too.
Yeah, he did a movie called The Men, where he played a paraplegic war veteran who became paralyzed in World War II, had to be in a wheelchair and couldn't adjust. Brando gets off the train from New York. He doesn't go to the Beverly Hilton. He doesn't go to get a place in Hollywood. He bunks in his aunt's living room, and then he moves into a veterans hospital for a month and lives as a paraplegic for a month, getting ready for the role. People didn't do that back then. Yeah. Now, you know, Robert De Niro will box a bunch of rounds for Raging Bull, or Daniel Day-Lewis will go become a shoemaker for a month. You know, people will live the roles. And Brando brought that kind of realism to Hollywood.
Yeah, he certainly helped me. Because, you know, he tried to get me fired right away. That story is belabored already. Yeah. But then we became friends. But the day I was doing the closing scene with Michael, where he confronts me, and today I solve all family business, he was on the set, and everybody's talking, all the ADs, who got number one on the set? Because his number was on one as the cast member, and he wasn't working that day. You couldn't get him there when he was supposed to work on time. He was there to help me, which I never forgot.
Well, it's funny, about 30 years ago, my writing partner and I wrote a movie, a biopic of Al Martino. We were friends with Al Martino, and we wrote Al's movie, Crazy Al. But Al told the story of how, you know, he was promised the role in The Godfather by Al Ruddy and Gray Fredrickson. He had some kind of deal with Al where he was going to get the role. And then Coppola didn't want him. Coppola did not want him in the role.
Couldn't act.
So
couldn't act a note. And I know his daughter is probably listening to this and hating me, but that's why Brando finally smacked him in the scene.
That's what he did. But also he said,
that was a real smack.
Al told us that he's standing offside, ready to do the scene. And he hears Brando say to Coppola, "What, this guy, he can't act. How's he going to do this scene? The guy better get drunk." So Al goes around the corner to a liquor store, gets a bottle of whiskey, comes down and puts the bottle down in front of Brando and says, "Sir, I heard what you said. You take the first shot, I'll take the next one." And Brando drank with him, got Al drunk, and that's how he got through his first scene. That's according to Al Martino.
That's bullshit, just so you know. I was there every day. That was my wedding scene.
You know, the thing about Brando, I interviewed Alex Rocco right before he passed away, and he was a nobody actor. And you know, he told me, he goes, "Mike, I had 3 days worth of work on The Godfather." He played Mo Green. And he said, "Brando was giving the producers, Al Ruddy, everybody such a hard time that my 3 days ended up being 6 months." He said, "I went from eating hamburgers to eating steaks." He goes, I don't know what it was about Brando. He was great with the cast. He was great with the crew. Soon as authority came on the set, he just shut his door or wouldn't come out or leave or whatever. Yeah, he just couldn't deal with authority.
Well, the funny thing to also remember is that at the time, nobody wanted Brando in the role, right? They wanted maybe Sinatra.
Nobody wanted him.
Box office poison, then, they called him.
And
right?
They finally got him. Then they fought to try to get Pacino. And that was like, they're ready to close the studio down.
Yeah, you were in the middle of all this. Yeah, you saw it all.
That's crazy. Well, Charlie Blue Dawn just bought, Gulf and Western just bought Paramount. And nobody realized it other than me and my friends. And Charlie Blue Dawn was connected to people in Milan, real guys. And the last thing he wanted to do is make his first picture about the mob.
Bert, you mentioned in the book, we're going to talk about The Wild One. Talk a little bit about how you got that part. And were there some other actors involved as well?
Oh, in The Wild One.
Yeah, The Wild One, yeah.
Yeah, so Brando makes The Men. He follows it up with the film version of A Streetcar Named Desire. Then he plays, he's Pancho Villa in Viva Zapata. And then the mumbler, does Shakespeare. He plays Mark Anthony and Julius Caesar. He gets Best Actor nominations for all three of those films, his second, third, fourth film. So what does he do after that? He makes a biker flick, right? Except back then there wasn't any such thing as a biker flick. You know, we look at these movies as movies for teenagers to watch in drive-ins and stuff. Back in 1953, there wasn't a youth market. You know, this was another Stanley Kramer picture. They thought they were making a film that was very serious about a serious issue of World War II veterans coming back from the war, having seen things they can't talk about and they can't fit into regular society. So what do? They take to the road in these gangs, and they get drunk and they cause trouble. At the same time, there's a big issue over juvenile delinquency after World War II and the baby boom. The kids are out on their own. They're out causing trouble. So this Brando really wanted this movie to make a difference and show that, you know, what these issues were. Well, of course, right away, the Breen Commission censors the movie, takes out all the parts that Brando wants in it. And in the end, you've just got this biker flick and the kids love it. And it kicks off really, you know, a year and a half before Rebel Without a Cause or Blackboard Jungle, Brando kicks off a rock and roll revolution and a youth revolution without any rock and roll in the movie at all. The only music in the movie is jazz. I mean, Brando was a jazz man. He liked to play his bongos and his conga drums.
Oh my God. He was my neighbor for a while. Oh my God. It's insane.
You mentioned in the book, we're talking 1953, the 50s, the motorcycle outlaw gangs, they were called 1%ers. What did that mean?
Well, what happened was they started getting a bad reputation. And then at one point, somebody who ran one of the legitimate motorcycle organizations said, "No, it's only like 1% of all the bikers are bad. Only 1%. And it was supposed to be kind of a shameful thing. But so they said, "Yeah, hey, yeah, we're part of the 1%. And they still use the 1%er today.
That's wild.
The famous line there, "What are you rebelling against, Johnny?"
And what he
said, "What do you got?" Who said, somebody else said that prior to that?
Well, Brando and Kramer and the director, Laszlo Benedek, had gone up to a place called Hollister, California. And that's where in 1947, there had been a motorcycle riot. And that's what the movie had been based on. There was an article that came out about it, and they based it on this article. And while they were talking to all of these bikers to try to learn the way they talked and to get the idea, Kramer asked them, "Say, what are you guys rebelling against?" And one of them said, "Well, what do you got?" And Brando wrote it down and remembered that line and kept it in.
It's amazing.
No, it's a, no, I mean, I've gotten to know the guy later. I produced a movie that called The Freshman with Matthew Broderick and Bruno Kirby, which he'd wanted to do just to, because he hated The Godfather. Because they topped him out. You know, they topped him out $1 million. Once he got to that, he got no more royalties.
Right. Oh, really?
Oh, yeah. That, I mean, that was an inside thing that nobody knew about. But it's he's a unique guy. I mean, it's, I don't know where you go in the book if you bring any of those strange parts about him out. But I used to go to his house. He was dressed as a woman sometimes.
There's a lot of strange stuff. I mean, Brando had a great impact on gay culture. And a lot went back to The Wild One. I mean, if you notice that, you know, Brando's group, the Black Rebel Motorcycle Club, they were all kind of fussy. They all wore these tight black leather jackets and had nice jeans with cuffs. Lee Marvin's gang comes in the middle of the picture, and they're dressed with army surplus clothes, with, you know, raccoon tail hats, and they're wearing kilts. They're all crazy. They look much more like the real motorcycle gangs. And Lee Marvin and the extras who are actual motorcycle gang members who were extras in the picture kind of made fun of Brando and his group. So look at those little sissies, all how nice they're dressed. Right. Well, what happens is that image of Brando in a leather jacket, that becomes the model for gay culture when they wanted to go against the sissified image that we always saw, the effeminate gay guy. Well, there's an artist named Tom of Finland who drew these pictures of these muscular guys in leather jackets and tight pants. And he got the idea from seeing The Wild One. So the influence just goes all over the place with him. You wouldn't have had the Leather Man and the Village People without Brando with a Wild One.
He created so many cultures, it's ridiculous.
Yeah. Lee Marvin would hit him with some sexual overtones. You know, his dialogue was a little, you know, sexual towards him.
That's the thing. That's one thing that people are picking up on now on the book. And there's a little bit debate about it, which is, you know, the first, you know, Lee Marvin's motorcycle gang comes into town. You find out that he and Brando have a past. They used to ride together. And the first thing that Lee Marvin says to him is, "Johnny, I missed you. I love you, Johnny. I love you." And then they wrestle. And then he's like, "You know, I love you, Johnny." He's telling how much he loves him. Yeah. And Brando, meanwhile, chooses to play this role with sort of a high-pitched, lisping voice. He's playing, you know, and when the women come around, his character kind of runs away from the women. So you look at it and go, oh, I can see why people give it this, you know, what they call now a queer subtext to this thing.
Right,
so pretty interesting, yeah.
The scene where he gets beat up towards the end by the two town folk, I remember you mentioned something in the book about that.
Well, I mean, there's a scene where he's accused of a killing that he didn't do.
Right.
The vigilantes from the town get him and they beat him up. And one guy punches him in the face and he says, "My old man could hit harder than that." And that was a little bit of Brando going back to his youth because his, you know, he didn't get along with his old man very well. And that was the sort of thing that kids identified with at the time. When he said that, I was like, whoa, this guy represents me.
I want to try to segue, if I can, Bert, into On the Waterfront. In 1952, director Ilya Kazan testified in named names before the House of Un-American Activities Committee in Washington, D.C. That really pissed Brando off, did it?
Well, yeah. I mean, what happened was when Kazan testified against people that he worked with, people that Brando worked with and looked up to, people that he worked with back in the 30s with the group theater, when a lot of these actors and a lot of these show business people were flirting with communism ideas, et cetera, he named the names and Brando found out about it. And he didn't know whether he should take the movie or not. He wasn't going to take the film. How can I work with this guy? And Kazan was Brando's favorite director, the only director who really understood him and really got him, you know, to work well on stage and on screen. He directed him in Viva Zapata, and he directed him in Streetcar on film. Well, he didn't want to do the picture, but Brando went to his psychiatrist, his his head shrinker. Thank you.
Psychoanalyst.
Talk about him real quick, if you can, Bert. Dr. Middleman.
Yeah, he went to Dr. Middleman, and Dr. Middleman said, "Look, you got to put your career first, and if you ever want to get over these problems you have, you got to learn to forgive a bit." So Brando took the role, But he said, okay, I'm going to take the role, which we're going to be shooting in New Jersey, but I want it in my contract. I'm leaving the set every day at 4 o'clock. And every day at 4 o'clock, he'd leave the set, go across the river to Dr. Middleman's couch to talk about that. And you wouldn't know that from watching the film.
Right.
You know?
Let's take a quick break. Sorry. I haven't wanted to break in here and mess up our flow because it's such great conversation. Tell us real quick the name of your book, and then let's go to a quick commercial.
The name of the book is Marlon Brando, Hollywood Rebel.
We got the Hollywood.
Right, we'll be right back. We're going to make some money. We know where you are. Don't move. We're introducing family dinners again. As we all know, Sunday sauce is almost abolished. Nobody wants to be cooking for 5 hours over sauce. So go to CorleoneFineItalian.com. You'll see a choice of 4 great sauces and get back to the family. In fact, we're even introducing trivia parties and dinners. Come as your favorite character as the Godfather and have dinner. Remember, CorleoneFineItalian.com. It's all there for you. It's an offer you can't refuse. All right, we're back. Great stories, man. The character, I mean, I don't know. I got to get the book just from my own personal experiences that I had with him.
Fantastic, Johnny. I read the book. It's fantastic. You should be very proud of yourself, Bert. Very good.
Thank you.
Bert, where can we get the book?
Wherever books are sold, I hope. I mean, it's online at Amazon.
Amazon, great.
And we got a website, marlonbrandobook.com, which has
fantastic. That makes it easy.
Signed copies there, etc.
Nice.
But yeah, it's a little different. It's not a straight biography of Brando. And again, I love movies, but I'm not like a cinephile, like a Roger Ebert. I'm not one of those people that like lives in movies. I embrace all of popular culture. So a lot of this was discoveries for me. I'd see Brando films for the first time, and I was like, wow, there's a movie called Bedtime Story made in the 1960s. He plays this gigolo who hooks up with David Niven on the Riviera to scam women and take money from women. Turns out other people knew this. I really didn't. The movie Dirty Rotten Scoundrels with Steve Martin and Michael Caine was not only based on this film, but I watched it side by side, and it's like scene by scene, it's the same picture.
Wow.
And what's that movie called?
Bedtime Story. And Brando does like a Jerry Lewis in it. He is so funny, which is another big surprise.
That is. Did he touch at all on his son in that murder that night?
Yeah. That's how I knew Brando. I was a television journalist in the early 90s. I worked on, tabloid television shows like A Current Affair and Hard Copy. And I'll never forget that there was a hierarchy of celebrities back then. It was like, there's Elizabeth Taylor, there's Jack Nicholson, there's Warren Beatty, there's Madonna, and there's Marlon Brando. This guy that, Marlon Brando lives up on that mountain up in the compound with Jack Nicholson. He never comes out, et cetera. And then one day you get the story that his son shoots the lover of his half sister in Marlon Brando's television room while Brando is in bed. And so what happens is they go to court, they go to the hearings, and all the media is outside. And I have a producer reporter there. I'm in New York, they're out in LA. And I say, if Brando comes out, if you're lucky enough to get a question to Marlon Brando, do say something. Anyway. The hearing is over the first day. Brando comes out of court with his attorney, Robert Shapiro, later.
You know the story, don't you, about that?
Tell
how
me.
How that happened?
No.
Steve, I just shot a guy in my club and killed him, October 28th. Steve Wynn had me fly to meet Robert Shapiro. I didn't need the guy. It's self-defense. People saw me do it. Brando called me up that night.
Wow.
He said, my son just shot his brother-in-law to be. And I said, did you call anybody? And he said, no. I said, don't call anybody. I called Shapiro in the middle of the night because Wynn gave me his number. And he said, what are you calling me so late for? That real attitude that he had to begin with.
Yeah.
And I said, somebody needs to talk to you. Well, tell him to call me in the morning. I said, it's Marlon Brando. He said, who? Why, it's a funny story. The next morning when they turned the kid in, Brando Shapiro and him turning the kid in. This is 4 hours later after he called him.
Yeah. Well, and the best thing after that first hearing was that not only did Brando come out, but he walks up to a microphone outside court and faces this wall of media.
Right.
All the reporters and cameramen. And the thing was, nobody asked a question. They all just stared at him like, I can't believe it. Marlon Brando's here. And he gave his speech about the messenger of misery coming to his house, et cetera. That became very famous. And I got on the phone to my producer and I said, you had the great white whale in front of you. You had Brando. If he ever comes out again, here's a list of questions. Throw these questions at him. And we sent the questions to the reporter. Well, Brando came out every day after the trial.
Yep.
And he worked the media, he worked the press. And behind the scenes, he got his daughter Cheyenne sent back to Tahiti so she wouldn't have to testify.
Well, we got him out right away.
Yeah.
We got her out right away. And I can't even tell you whose plane we used. A major, major friend, singer.
You know all the insights.
Yeah, because if she testified, the kid would, you know, he got away with, I mean, it.
Yeah.
What he got for a murder, but you know, they're also in his defense, the guy was beating up the sister on a regular basis, so they had all the police reports of the brutality.
Yeah,
but then he gets out and he hangs himself, kills himself. Yeah.
Did the daughter pass away as well?
The daughter hanged herself back at Tahiti. It was very sad, a very sad story.
It was, oh my god, yeah, yeah.
But that was, you know, but that was Brando again, talk about influence. That was one of the first, you know, court TV, wall-to-wall coverage of a courtroom trial. And then Brando had to testify. And everybody remembers that, where he managed to fit himself into that, you know, witness booth with his ponytail, and he cried. And the victim's father said it was, you know, Brando's best performance ever. And it really was. Yeah. You can fast forward like 20, 30 years, and there's Johnny Depp in court.
Yeah.
He's got a ponytail. And I'm talking to Gray Fredrickson, the producer from The Godfather, and he says, "Did you see Johnny Depp on the witness stand? He was doing a Brando. He was doing Brando." Just the way he was talking. And I was like,
"Oh, he influenced so many lives. Mine, forget about it. I mean, I'd go on and on and on. He was so generous to me. That's great, John. I can't wait to read your book, man. This is going to be
fantastic, insane. Johnny. Fantastic." A+.
Who's the publishing house?
Applause Theater and Cinema Books. Applause. They do a lot of movie books and celebrity books like that. Yeah.
Is there an audio version or just
the book? Not yet. I would love to get my friend Michael Madsen to do the audio version. It's funny.
Great Madsen,
when I did the book on Lawrence Tierney. Madsen, of course, starred in Reservoir Dogs with Lawrence Tierney and told me some great stories. I got in touch with Madsen because I found out that he co-starred with Brando in Brando's last screen appearance, which turned out to be a Michael Jackson video called You Rock My World, where Brando played like a godfather figure and Madsen played a criminal type or a mobster. Anyway, I talked to Madsen and he goes, "Oh yeah, you know, Christian, Brando's son, we were great friends when I first came to Hollywood. We had a welding business together and I knew Brando as Christian's dad." Which was crazy.
Wow, that's wild, man.
Yeah, I interviewed Michael. Get him on the show. I've been trying to reach out to him. It was a great interview.
I think he had a burner phone. I lost his phone number.
I want to ask you, Bert, 1955, Guys and Dolls. You know, obviously, Brando, Sky Masterson, and Sinatra's Nate. Nathan Detroit.
Yeah.
I know that they weren't really crazy about each other. Talk a little bit about that if you can.
Well, first of all, Sinatra could sing.
Right.
Yeah.
Brando could. And Sinatra wanted that lead role. He wanted to play Sky Masterson. And he also had a bone to pick with Brando because there's a producer named Sam Spiegel who produced On the Waterfront.
Hello.
And he was the one who got Brando to get the role. But at the same time, he signed Sinatra for the role in On the Waterfront. And never told Sinatra that really I want Brando. And then he got Brando and just left Sinatra hanging. Sinatra sued over it.
Oh, wow. And that's enough. You know what's so funny about that history? They shot that in Hoboken so they could have the New York skyline.
Right.
I don't know if you know this. On the breaks, he'd go to the bar where Dolly Sinatra was the barmaid, Sinatra's mother.
Right, that's right. That's great. Wow.
I mean, this stuff you can't make up.
Yeah, so and so Sinatra really had it with Brando. He wanted that role in Guys and Dolls, and so they wrote some extra songs for Sinatra for the film. And it's funny, by the time he's making that picture, everything's blowing up, you know, youth-wise. You know, all the kids. James Dean is now big. He might have even been dead by then. And everybody's saying, you know, Marlon Brando, you're the man. I mean, James Dean was in love with Brando, but he really was in love with the character from The Wild One. And Brando's like, that's not me. You know, you need a psychiatrist, kid. Leave me alone. You know, and he moved on. That was a role. I'm not that person. And so Brando took no credit at all for, you know, what he caused. Because he said, I did an acting role. Like, I'm sorry for that.
You mentioned in the book that I guess Brando was at a party one night and James Dean was very nervous because, oh, my God, there's Brando. And he went up to him. And what happened?
And Brando said, kid, you know, you got to do your own thing. You got to leave me alone. Yeah, and then he said, you know, I think you should see a psychiatrist to work out the issues.
I iced him.
Is that bad?
Yeah.
Oh my God. That is wild, though. My God, this book is going to be a monster.
Yeah. Well, James,
I know so many Brando fans.
Yeah, yeah.
Thank you for giving us the privilege of announcing. Well,
James Dean was going to be up for the Terry Molloy role in On the Waterfront as well.
Right. There's a lot of back and forth with all these kind of roles. I mean, then you get Elvis Presley gets into the mix. You know, Elvis Presley gets his first record contract. And what he really wanted was to be an actor. He wanted to be Marlon Brando, and he said that. You know, it's funny. I found an article from like 1955. Elvis Presley, this is before he really hit it big. He's being interviewed in the Peabody Hotel in Memphis, Tennessee, by Lloyd Shearer, who later went on to be Parade Magazine. Obviously, Lloyd Shearer and Parade back when I was growing up. And he's interviewing Elvis, and Elvis is being very nice, going, calling him sir, et cetera. And then Shearer takes out the camera. And Elvis says, whoa, stop. You can't don't take my picture. You cannot get a picture of me smiling. Because you know Marlon Brando, he'll never get a picture of Marlon Brando smiling. You got to be a rebel. So let me get my face.
Oh, my word. First. Got his pose ready. That's awesome.
Elvis loved Brando. He loved Brando. I mean, everything he did was influenced by Brando, a lot of it.
Well, it's funny.
Well, it's so funny that you should say that, Mike, because at Suite 3000 at the Hilton, we would go back there 4 or 5 o'clock in the morning and look for every old film that Brando was in, and he had them up there. We'd sit there till the sun came up watching Brando. And then, yeah, then here we are later on talking about it and being a part of it.
But the Elvis suite.
Yeah. The Elvis, thank God no one's ever above us, because we had such gun battles in there with real guns and shot through the ceiling and all that.
Oh, I did a story on the Elvis suite for A Current Affair, like back in 1989. And we went up there. And there were bullet holes in like the private elevator. And the guy was pointing out the bullet holes in the ceiling.
Oh, yeah. We shot everything up. All of us carried guns. It was so funny. And he had a gold cup, a solid gold cup, 45, and he got mustered out. The crew, I mean, our government bought it for him. He went everywhere with it. So I always carry guns. So we're watching a Western. First time we knew about the guns. He turns the couch over and we're having a gunfight. Obviously, we're shooting over each other's head, but they were up there so many times fixing those ceilings. But if there was a floor above us, there wouldn't have been hotel guests killed once a month.
That would have been it. That's funny. You know, it's funny. You talk about Westerns. When Elvis got out of the army, they tried to put him in a couple of serious pictures, because by the time he went into the army, he did the movie King Creole. And that was originally a movie written for James Dean. James Dean dies. And so they move it from Brooklyn to New Orleans, add some songs, and then Brando, and then Elvis plays King Creole. And the critics go, wow, this kid can act. He's actually really good. Yeah. And then he goes in the army. He comes out. They put him in a movie called Flaming Star, where he plays a half-breed, like a half-Indian. That movie was originally written for Marlon Brando and Frank Sinatra.
Oh, wow.
And
wow.
Elvis did it instead. So all
that's
this
great trivia. Is
crazy. Somebody
you should come on as a regular guest.
I'm excited to get this book. Yeah. I don't spend a lot of time reading. I'm a big fan of audio because I'm not a good person to do much sitting down, but it sounds like something I will sit down and take a minute to read. And, you know, my mom, she's in her later 80s and she loves to read. So I'll be looking to get one for her as well.
Yeah.
Sounds like a great book.
For our audience out there, you know, please, I mean, it came out April 2nd, a couple weeks ago. It's been burning up Amazon from what I've been reading. And I read the book. It's fantastic. Bert was kind enough to send it to me. Great book. Real quick, I want to ask you a couple more questions before we hang it up. So what was the relationship between Paul Newman and Brando? Because I know Newman came on, you know, after Strasburg. He was hot. He was a good looking guy. But a lot of the people are like, yeah, he's good, but he ain't no Brando.
The problem with Paul Newman was that he was in Brando's shadow.
Right.
And everything he did, he got compared to Marlon Brando. They didn't really look alike, but then again, he makes a motion picture called Somebody Up There Likes Me, with about Rocky Graziano, the fighter turned entertainer. Well, it turns out that Rocky Graziano was the model for Stanley Kowalski when Brando was on Broadway, because Brando would hang out at this boxing gym in Times Square where Rocky was hanging out. Rocky didn't know who Brando was. He thought he was some kid with a bad motorcycle and wearing jeans all the time. And Rocky's watches, he saw the play. He goes, wait a minute, he's doing me. That's me that I'm looking at there. And so oddly enough, you know, Newman, in trying to break away from Brando's shadow, plays Rocky Graziano when Somebody Up There Likes Me, and kind of was able to step out by doing that.
Wow.
Did it work?
Yeah.
I don't think so.
Yeah.
Amazing.
You have too much. Mike, I mean, we got to get you back if you don't want.
Yeah, we'll get back.
Maybe a couple of months.
I want to get you back on, Bert, for the Lawrence Tierney book. That's the one I want to read.
Well, I got another book coming out in October on another great actor, Shemp Howard.
Wow. Well, listen, anytime you want to promote your books, you got an open invitation with us, man.
It's an honor to be here. It's terrific. Thank you for having me.
And I don't know if you know our stats. We're at 50 million views now.
It's terrific.
You deserve. So hopefully we'll sell you some books.
Yeah, that sounds great. We'll tag you in our posts if that's okay, and see if we can have a little link to your book as well. So we're really excited to help you promote that. It sounds fantastic.
Oh, thanks so much.
It looks like we lost Mike for a minute there. Maybe he'll be able to jump off and back on. But we sure thank you for coming on and wish you the best with that book. It doesn't sound like you're going to need luck because it sounds fantastic. So
I hope I didn't talk too much.
No, please.
Oh, absolutely not.
No, every I was hanging on every word you said, please. And I'm sure our audience was too. And I'll say goodbye to Mike for you.
All right.
Thanks
so much, everybody.
People around me certain times disappear. We don't know what happens.
Oh, no. Cool. Thanks so much.
I mean, you are amazing. Thank you.
As are you, sir.
Fantastic.
God bless you. Thank you for being on.
Thanks a lot. Take care.
Thank you. Have a good night.
You too.
Bye-bye.
Well, I don't know what happened to Mike, but if he shows up next week, you'll see him.
Yeah.
Have a great weekend. Be careful out there. Jeannie, love you. Good night.
Love you. Thank you so much, Attaball. Nice to meet you, Bert.
You too. Thanks, Jeannie. Thanks,
bye-bye,
everybody.
Dear.
And that was that. But I'll be back. No regrets, no complaints. Lived a life with no restraints. The little kid they all counted out, proved them all wrong, that's without a doubt. Laying there with my left side numb, 5-year bout with polio, but yes, I won. From standing on corners like, how many pens you want, to living in a bakery, then opening my own restaurant. Of course, I had some help along the way, friends like Frank Costello that I miss each and every day. Things from many years ago still resonate.